You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is novelist Nathaniel Rich. His second novel examines the nature of fear, both real and imagined ones, and how our complex media environment helps stoke it. In Odds Against Tomorrow, a novel, we meet brilliant mathematician Mitchell Zucker, who's tortured by fears of the next pandemic, the next act of terror, the next natural disaster, financial collapse, war, or man-made disaster. Well, Mitchell's job displays his natural talents, warning big business executives about the worst-case scenarios in every conceivable or inconceivable disaster scenario. But what happens when a real disaster strikes? That's the real story of Odds Against Tomorrow. Rich is the author also of The Mayor's Tongues. His essays and short fiction have appeared in Harper's, The New York Review of Books, McSweeney's, and The New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of the nonfiction book about film noir, San Francisco Noir, the city in film noir from 1940 to the present. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Nathaniel Rich, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
As a book, it's a really wonderful read, and your use of language in it is really wonderful. You describe this quantitative gentleman who is the sum of all fears. If I can steal something from Tom Clancy, tell us how you came up with this character of Mitchell Zucker.
Well, I wanted to write about obsession. That's sort of my big theme I've discovered, and I feel like the obsession of our time is fear. You know, and you can't go on the internet, check your news sites, check your email, check social media without finding, you know, the new antibiotic-resistant super flu that's coming to get us, you know, from China, or nuclear Iran or nuclear North Korea, or some new act of terrorism or financial calamity that's coming our way and so on. So I wanted to write about a character who takes these things to heart, because I think normally we've become kind of numb to this type of news, to this barrage, and we tend to tune it out until something truly shocking happens, although increasingly what counts as truly shocking, you know, the goalposts keep getting moved, right?
That's right.
And so I wanted to try to write about these anxieties and anxieties about the future and through a character who really takes it to heart. And so I developed this character of Mitchell, who becomes obsessed with – a mathematician who becomes obsessed with worst-case scenarios, and he gets hired sort of fortuitously at this mysterious financial consulting firm, Future World, where his job is to predict worst-case scenarios for his corporate clients, but it's also kind of a nightmare job because he descends down this kind of spiral of obsession and paranoia until an actual worst-case scenario comes to pass.
It's actually, you know, you've actually simplified his journey, because actually at times it's soothing because he's giving voice to his fears. When we first meet him, he's still an undergraduate at the University of Chicago, and this is the nerd's nerds.
Well, I wanted to write about a mathematician. You know, I feel like to really talk about a lot of these fears, to get past a certain level, you have to use math. You know, we're inundated with all these crazy things, you know, about asteroids coming to hit us, or the supervolcano that's going to erupt, you know, under Yellowstone and destroy the planet. We never are really told exactly how likely the things are to happen, or we're given some kind of glib figure, but it's not, it doesn't usually have much credibility. And so I felt like to really get into this stuff and try to understand, well, what should we be afraid of? You need a mathematician. And I feel like there aren't many novels about mathematicians. But I felt that, and I'm not myself, you know, an expert mathematician, but I...
You throw around formulas in the book. So I wanted to know if that is gibberish or real.
Well, the real formula in there, there, you know, I did some math, right? But it's not, it's never sort of too technical, I think. And basically what I wanted to write about is the way that the allure that I think numbers have and statistics for a mathematician is very similar to the attraction, you know, the consolations that, say, people who like reading find in literature. You know, we read novels or poetry to have a sense of beauty, to cause reflection, you know, self-reflection. And I think people who are mathematically inclined look to numbers for beauty as well, and there is a lot of beauty in numbers. And so I wanted to write about a mathematician who sort of both, you know, did the math but also was consoled by the math. And he's consoled by doing the math on all these scenarios and allaying his fears when he finds out that you know, the odds maybe are not that high in most cases.
So he's at the University of Chicago when a super disaster occurs. Seattle is hit by a super earthquake and is literally destroyed. And this becomes the impetus for his story as we move along, as he becomes a risk analyst of some sort. And he's given an assignment to determine what the worst case scenario is for his company if a similar disaster hit on the 75th floor of the Empire State Building where he works, where his company is located. And he has to turn all these numbers over. And that's when he begins to descend in this. Well, he was always in this rabbit hole. He sort of thrived in it in a way and worked out the math and figured out, okay, it's not likely to happen. And that gave him some relief.
Well,
he's a tortured soul.
he begins the novel certainly as a tortured soul, and he makes it harder on himself when he gets scooped up by these financial firms who understand how they could use his mathematical ability and also his predilection to doom and his tendency to obsess over worst-case scenarios as a way of making money. And I think this is something that I think a lot of readers might find familiar. I mean, you see this type of cynical thing in a lot of, you know, articles you might read about high finance, you know, Manhattan high finance.
We'll sell crap mortgages, but we're going to ship them off to somebody else. It won't be our problem.
Right.
Yeah. It's that sort of passing the buck.
Yeah. And so basically he's in the novel, he stumbled into this high risk fear market, which is kind of successor to what we saw maybe in 2008. Actually started writing the novel in 2007. But I think reflecting back on it now, I think there was already a sense in the air, if we didn't know the details about, you know, credit derivative swaps or what have you, there was a sense in the air that something shady was going on and it was complicated and only real quants like Mitchell, these sort of financial mathematicians, knew what was going on and they were kind of pulling a fast one. So Mitchell himself is not at all cynical. So he's kind of ill-suited for this job, but his skills are perfect. So he gets recruited, but instead of kind of coolly and cynically using the numbers to make a profit, he takes it to heart and becomes really worried.
Yeah, the plot twist is this group called Future World, who basically have seen the companies in Seattle ruined by this earthquake and class action lawsuits because they were housing their people in high rises. Well, this company has come up with a novel approach for New York because there's a law that says if you take appropriate forethought in dealing with disasters, you're indemnified.
Yeah.
And so they sell this high-priced insurance to give them the worst-case scenarios, and that's Mitchell's job because, as his client friend says, I says, I don't really believe this. You believe it.
Right. Well, after September 11th, you know, it became very difficult for corporations to buy catastrophe risk because the insurers were burned after 9/11, and they had to pay out huge sums of money. And so this is a real thing. There's sort of a slight gap in the market for high catastrophe insurance. And so Future World has stumbled on a very cynical shell game by which they can kind of fill that gap and through a kind of consulting trick make money off of that little loophole.
In writing this book, you had to spend a lot of time on the internet and some of the darker, danker parts of the internet, I would have to think, to come up with all the scenarios that Mitchell is going through his head and spouting off to his clients. I mean, it's everything from pandemics, why the next pandemic hasn't happened, to natural disasters, to nanotechnology run amok, to, I mean, there's everything you could possibly come up with. He's spouting it.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I wrote it over the course of 5 years. And yeah, there were periods when I was first writing some of those early scenes when he's freaking out about all these scenarios and predicting them that I did some research. But the truth is, during that time, whenever I would encounter some kind of scary news story about one of these things,
you probably had to go to Huffington Post.
Well, you know, but that's the thing is you don't have to seek it out. And that's sort of what the novel's about. If you have any tendency to seek it out, yeah, you can go down these wormholes and you can find for instance, there's this whole disaster literature of disaster journals, academic journals. So my favorite is or industry journals, Food Safety Magazine. Like you'll never eat out again or buy anything in a wrapped package again, or Emerging Infectious Diseases, quarterly, things like that. So if you have any inclination, you can really freak yourself out. But really, a lot of the research was passive because we're getting this stuff every day. I mean, if you just keep your eyes open, or even if you don't, if you watch a little bit of cable news or you watch You just go on like Yahoo News or something, or the information comes at you. And so this is sort of more than the actual details of these sort of different types of wide range of events that could be coming for us and spelling our doom. I was really interested in writing about what it does to us, you know, how it affects our daily lives, our daily relationships with people we care about, our sort of intimate personal lives, to be inundated with all of this information. And most of the information is scary information, you know. And so it's fear sells, right? Fear is big business. And so fear and celebrity. And so I was writing about if you go online, those are things that you read about. So I was writing about the fear side of it. And the question for me, and what I think the novel can get at, as opposed to, say, a nonfiction book or an essay, is that intersection between the public sphere and, you know, the press and the private inner life, and how these things interact.
I was struck as I was reading the book about how the nature of fear has changed, because Mitchell runs across the doomsday preacher in Midtown Manhattan who's, you know, preaching old school fire and brimstone. You think about man over the last 1,000 years. For a good part of that last 1,000 years, it was simply that. It was the fire and brimstone. It was God destroying the world. Either God's going to destroy my life or, you know, I'm allowed to live. And then all of a sudden in the 20th century, things start changing. And then it's, you know, the Cold War. It's all these sorts of things happening. And now it's everything. You know, there's a laundry list as long as your arm.
Right. And a lot of shapeless, amorphous fears. You know, yeah. Something like climate change. There's all types of different ramifications that you can hear about that, and without a sort of sense of certainty about anything that might, you know, you don't know necessarily that you're all of a sudden going to be, you know, that Tulsa is going to turn into a desert, say, but that's one possible scenario that you might read about.
It might be beachfront property.
Or exactly, right. And so that's kind of a looming long-term anxiety. And but yeah, people, you know, I think people, readers sometimes get the wrong impression about me personally, having sometimes reading the book, especially in the early parts of the book, that I'm kind of doom and gloom and paranoid. But the truth of the matter is, you know, I'd much rather, you know, people will say, like, would you rather live in a different time? Like, of course not. Like, I wouldn't rather be living in, you know, 1349 Europe during the plague years, like before medicine.
That's right. Instance, your life expectancy is 29.
Right. Yeah, you ever think about how many times you'd be dead if there wasn't medicine, you know, all the different infections that would spiral out, you know. And so we actually live in a very safe time. You know, life expectancy is higher than ever before. Education is higher and so on. And yet, I don't think we've ever lived in a time where we've had so much information about all the things that could kill us. And so there's this sort of comical in some ways and sometimes horrific contradiction there, or there's something jarring about that. And so we become more neurotic and anxious, or at least I find myself becoming more neurotic and anxious unless I tune everything out. But that's also not necessarily the right response either. I mean, you know, these are questions that I think everyone has to resolve for themselves. Like, do you just blot out all the bad news? Do you, you know, ignore it? Do you become cynical? Do you become numb? Or do you become some kind of activist, you know, and pick a cause and dedicate your life? You know, they're all sort of rational responses, but everybody makes their own choices. And so I want to write about, well, how do we make those choices? You know, and ignoring it is a choice also.
My guest today is Nathaniel Rich. He is the author of Odds Against Tomorrow, a novel published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And tells the story of Mitchell Zucker, who is a statistician who's working, who has enormous, there was a word you coined about phobias, which I really enjoyed. It was like phobalist or something.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of, I use the root phobia as many possible times. Yeah, there's yes. He visits a phobopolis.
Yeah. He referred to, I think, New York as a phobopolis.
Yeah.
Yes, right. That's right. That was
Terror City, yeah.
But it's a funny, entertaining, and thinking. It's a good novel. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, would you read a little section? This gives a good sense of who Mitchell is, and this is pretty early in the novel. He's contemplating this switch to Future World from his old firm.
Right. So he's leaving Fitzsimmons Sherman, which is a kind of stand-in for Goldman Sachs, say, and he's thinking about joining this new kind of mysterious future consulting firm that he's been recruited to. And this takes place after he comes home one night after work. Microwaves were all right, as long as you stood in the next room while they operated. Put the frozen burrito in the oven, set the timer, press start, then run. Mitchell felt desperate sitting there on the couch, a paper plate and plastic fork on his lap while the microwave whirred in the kitchen. It wasn't the plastic or the couch's sour, pasty smell so much as it was the waiting. He'd waited patiently for college to end so that he could join Fitzsimmons Sherman, where he had waited patiently for a chance at risk. Then came the valuation project and failure. But why? Had he disappointed Sherman? He didn't think so, but it was impossible to know. In any case, that opportunity had passed, and he would have to wait once more. When he woke the next morning, his career, and by minimal extension, his entire life, would change. He would be an E&V man. He might have to wait there a very long time. The microwave bleated. He nudged the burrito onto the paper plate, which sagged from the heat. Perhaps he was being too hard on himself. Hadn't he felt the same kind of dread before starting at Fitzsimmons? When he learned that he would be working on the 75th floor of the Empire State Building, he had done some research on elevator accidents. To his horror, he immediately discovered that the most catastrophic accident in the history of building transportation technology was called the Empire State Building Incident. On July 28, 1945, Lieutenant Colonel William Franklin Smith, Jr., a 27-year-old B-25 bomber pilot, was flying through increasing fog from Bedford, Massachusetts, to Newark Airport, where he was to retrieve his commanding officer. 25 miles short of Newark, Smith radioed the air traffic controller for a weather report. "From what I'm seeing," said the controller, "I can't see the top of the Empire State Building." But Smith continued toward Manhattan. After passing the Chrysler Building, he became disoriented when a sudden burst of air pushed the airplane to one side, and he turned right instead of left. Within seconds, he crashed into the 79th floor of the Empire State Building. The hoist and safety cables of two of the elevators snapped. One of these elevators, which was being operated by a woman named Betty Lou Oliver, plunged from the 75th floor, the very floor Mitchell would be working on. Luckily for Betty Lou, who was cowering in a fetal position on the floor of the elevator, the falling car compressed the air in the shaft, creating a landing cushion that softened the blow at the bottom. She broke her back and both legs, but survived. Mitchell skipped the elevator, but after climbing 75 flights of stairs, his suit, a Hungarian tri-blend inherited from his father, Tibor, was nearly translucent with sweat, and he had decided to run the numbers. In the United States, there were 900,000 elevators, each serving an average of 20,000 people per year. That meant 18 billion passenger trips per year. These trips resulted in 27 deaths. The chance of dying in an elevator accident was therefore 1 in 10.44, repeating, million, about equivalent to the odds of dying from a dog bite, according to the National Safety Council odds of death chart he kept in his wallet. This made him easier about entering the metal box every morning, but he did find himself crossing the street whenever he saw a dog. It hadn't been lost on him that Future World's office was on the second floor.
That is so wonderful. That I think that sums up Mitchell pretty well.
Yeah, that's Mitchell in a nutshell, I think.
Well,
That's real, by the way, the Empire State Building accident.
Yes.
And I had him, and Mitchell was working, and that was a case where I checked to see what the most disastrous elevator accident was, and Mitchell had this job in Empire State Building. I was already in the novel, and I found out, sure enough, yes, the worst elevator accident occurred in the Empire State Building.
Well, contrasting Mitchell is a character that you also introduced at the beginning of the novel. This is Elsa Bruner. And Mitchell had met her on his daily journey to the student health services, where he had, a very large file of imagined maladies. But in the course, he learned that she had an interesting condition. And, of course, this manifests itself at the very beginning of the novel.
Yeah, it's called the Brugada syndrome, which is a real condition, which is that essentially you're very healthy and show no outward signs of being sick, except that at any moment you can just drop dead. Your heart can stop beating. So she's essentially a walking worst case scenario. And he's mesmerized by her intimidated by her because she has every reason just to be paranoid and fearful and not be able to get out of bed every morning. But instead, she is this very idealistic, optimistic, cheerful person. And she goes and starts a farm in Maine with some friends, a cooperative farm. And he's sort of can't understand how she can get on with her life and be so happy when he's so miserable and he has really no reason to be miserable. He's healthy. He's making a lot of money at this finance job in New York. He has good relationship with his parents and so on. And he lives in constant terror. and she, on the other hand, is sort of his opposite. And so they start a correspondence where he's trying to kind of get to the bottom of it and trying to understand if she's figured out some trick that he can use.
But there's an interesting bit of foreshadowing, too, at the very beginning of the novel, which is when the word about Seattle comes, they're sitting in a class. He's never even met her, but he instinctively goes into action and says, she's in trouble. And he actually takes a step that probably saved her life. And later in the novel, without giving anything away, we find that it's when the moment that most of us are paralyzed by fear, Mitchell's already worked out all the worst parts of it so he can actually react.
He's uniquely prepared, both to profit from disaster, but also to respond to it. I mean, there's one incredible thing I learned about while doing research for the novel is that there's a psychological term for it that's now escaping me. But when people are confronted by real catastrophe, so, when you're on a cruise ship that's starting to sink, a very surprisingly common response is just to not do anything and just to freeze and to sort of assume that things will get better. Someone's going to fix the problem, And so it's the same reason why a shocking number of people who die from parachute jumping never even pulled the ripcord on the backup parachute, the safety parachute. So you've kind of shut down. And the reason is, our brains work on pattern recognition. And when you're confronted with a real catastrophe in your own life and not, in a Hollywood movie, say, you have no context for it. There's no pattern that you can recognize. And so people shut down. And Mitchell, of course, having visualized every possible thing that can go wrong in every type of scenario, he is sort of uniquely prepared to deal with it, actually.
But there's also this great relationship where he is paralyzed by these unmentionable fears. She's living her life with a all too real fear. And, it's kind of funny how things work out as
well,
the book goes along.
Yeah, and this is also something I wanted to write about is that, these abstract, large worst-case scenarios can be very convenient. It's a lot easier, for instance, to go online and start reading about what would happen if a huge earthquake hit your city, say, than maybe, working on your relationship with your family or your relationship with your spouse or getting back in touch with that friend that you've lost track of, but, you heard there's a death in his family, say. So those kinds of personal, intimate crises tend to really have higher stakes, I think, for us, for good reason. And yet it's a kind of emotional procrastination is to get wrapped up in things that are really outside of our control and are abstract and vast instead of dealing with things that we can control. And so that's one thing that doing all this research for the book helped me in my own life with is that it kind of made me, cherish the things that I did have more. And it allowed me to kind of not think about all these scenarios very much, these things that were outside of my control and hopefully force myself to deal with things that I can control and can improve,
My guest today is Nathaniel Rich. His new novel is titled Odds Against Tomorrow. It's a great read, and it's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You mentioned you were writing this in 2007, 2008, as all this Wall Street thing was unwinding. And, as TV movies have now reminded us and movies in general have reminded us, this was kind of that fall of 2008. It was a real period of crazy uncertainty. And I was wondering how that affected you as you're writing this.
It was strange. I mean, a few things happened while I was writing it that, disrupted or basically, it's like the world that I was writing about entered the real world, So yeah, I was writing about sort of high finance chicanery. And then all of a sudden you have in 2008, as I was finishing the first draft, this huge collapse of the financial industry. A more dramatic example is probably the main, and I don't think it's giving away too much because it's on the cover, but a picture of flood in New York City. But there's the worst case scenario that does hit is a huge earthquake. That's next. It's a huge a hurricane that causes massive flooding. And so I was editing the final proofs of the novel when Sandy hit, and it was I had just time enough to sort of insert one little mention of Sandy, but I was also very callously selfishly concerned that I'd have to rewrite or delay publication or rewrite a huge section of it if what happened in the storm didn't jive with what was in the book. And it turned out that it actually
unfortunately
it was exactly what's in the book, and the reason is not because I'm a prophet, but because I was drawing from research that was done by government agencies and scientists. There was a report by the Army Corps of Engineers in the mid-90s that predicted in quite precise detail exactly what would happen in a Category 1, Category 2, Category 3 storm. And so Sandy, although it was treated, I think, by the media at the time as this shocking event that no one could have foreseen, actually every detail had been foreseen, and the government agencies that were dealing with it and scientists who'd studied it knew exactly what would happen.
And if I lived in New York City and I read your book and I found out what a Category 3 or 4 storm did, I would be really scared.
Yeah, and the other thing...
Because we're talking like the day after tomorrow.
Well, yeah.
Sort of scenario.
You know, my book is Category 3. It goes up to Category 5.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, if it was Category 5, it'd be an apocalyptic novel, not just sort of a disaster novel. But... they've hit before, you know. It's just that people don't remember it, or the city wasn't the city it is now. So there was a storm in the 19th century, a hurricane that caused the East River and the Hudson River on either side of Manhattan to flood and meet in the middle of the island in what's now Soho. So we know that nature can do it, and if nature's done something before, it'll do it again. It's just that we don't have – again, it's this question of pattern recognition. We've never seen it, so we think it's – not going to happen. But of course, you know, nature works on a different timeline.
Now, you live in New Orleans now, and you were not there during Katrina, but having been there for about the last several years, you have to soak up a lot of the vibe of how that storm has changed the community and how it's changed how people react. I mean, you had a storm last year, a couple storms last year, the last couple of years.
I had the strange experience of being in New York for Katrina and then moving to New Orleans and then having Sandy hit New York while I was in New Orleans. And even the storm that hit New Orleans last year, I was visiting family in New York. So I sort of miss it. I'm like the opposite of Mitchell. Like fortunately, the natural disasters sort of miss me at each turn. But I read a lot about Katrina when it happened. I mean, as we all did, and I saw the images, and I was familiar with the basic sort of political debates that were going on in the aftermath, locally as well as nationally. But it's different living there. I mean, you really understand in a more visceral way both the physical transformation of the landscape. I mean, there are parts of the city that not only that they still are destroyed from the storm, it's that they've been reconfigured in ways that, you know, ecologically they're different. You know, they were cleared away, and what's taken the place of what the type of flora and even fauna that was there before is different. And so it's total reconfiguration of the physical landscape, but then the psychological landscape is also completely reconfigured, and it's your daily life. It's in the air you breathe. Everyone, the storm is on everyone's lips still.
I was struck by the fact that there are three hospitals. These are big hospitals.
Yeah, massive hospitals. Yeah.
That they look like Chernobyl.
Yeah,
And you have to remember that there were people working there, patients filled those hospitals, and now they're like a big giant ghost structure.
Yeah, and I don't want to give the wrong impression about the city, because it's actually come back in a lot of ways, and in some ways that are exciting and sort of improved, I think, upon what was there before. And I think since the last census, it's the fastest growing city in America. So there's a lot of exciting things going on there. You know, it's still a great place to visit, but yeah, there's a trauma, and that absolutely, you know, unlike Sandy, which I didn't really cause me to revise anything, living there. And you know, speaking with people in neighborhoods that had been destroyed, I really made me want to really rewrite the final section of the novel, which takes place after a storm. You know, New Orleans might not even be mentioned in the novel, but I think for a lot of readers there have commented to me that it feels like a New Orleans novel, you know, in its soul. And so that's gratifying. That's something I wanted to represent in the novel in some way, if only subliminally.
Nathaniel Rich, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Novelist Nathaniel Rich speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the author of The Mayor's Tongue and his most recent book, Odds Against Tomorrow, a novel. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.